You can see my award-winning climate comedy show Spoilers at a festival near you, provided you live near or are going to McCunclith or Wells comedy festivals. More dates added soon near you, conceivably, who knows what might happen.
And if you are at Mac, come and see ComCom Redacted live at 4 p.m. on the Saturday.
Go to stuartgoldsmith.com and click the very attractive banner image to find out more.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
This is a podcast from ComediansComedian.com.
This is the Comedians Comedian Podcast.
Hello and welcome to the show. I'm Stuart Goldsmith, and today I'm talking to Jess Robinson, an incredibly talented and accomplished singer and impressionist, and someone who's able to combine those skills to caricature and characterize your favorite singers in incredible ways and get her voice to have such elasticity that she can brilliantly mimic and kind of point up the elements in other singers' voices. She's so funny, and she is such an incredible live performer, and seeing her is an incredible live experience. So do look forward to this, and do try and get to see her live whenever you can. I'm just going to say at the beginning of this episode that we had a certain level of depth to the conversation, and I felt Jess was holding back, and I called her on it, and then we achieved a bit more depth to it. So that's just something to bear in mind. I suppose I was a little bit concerned afterwards as to whether I'd been tough on her. But she's a friend, and I felt she trusted me to do that. Jess, I know you'll be listening to this now. Don't worry, I think you come out of this great. And I'm really so pleased that she decided to be so honest. And after some interesting stuff, we managed to get into some interesting and rather deeper stuff. So I hope you enjoyed this episode with the wonderful Jess Robinson. One of the ways that I sort of enjoy, in a perverse way, starting conversations like this is to force you to explain who you are and what you do, which I know everyone hates, but I think you will find it easier than most comics because what you do is quite specialised.
Yeah.
So tell us what that is.
So, oh God, I feel like a fraud, massive wanker twat. I do impressions, and I do singing impressions, and I mock celebrities, and I'm sort of surprised that I'm here because I like to be a comedian, but I don't think of myself on the same level as any other stand-up comic that goes out there and, you know, does clubs night after night, because I feel like what I do is so different, and I feel sometimes that people will be a bit sneery about what I do because it's quite mainstream, it's quite sort of Saturday night. I did that bougie cheese thing, and I'm a wanker fraud.
Okay, well let's kind of dig into that, because I should have started with this. Last time we gigged together was at that thing for Waverley Care in Edinburgh.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So it was kind of a black tie, I mean, a corporate, you could say. It was a sort of charity thing. I
forgot that, yeah.
I'd seen you before. I'd seen you at the Amused Moose final, where I believe you were the People's Champion.
Yes, and you gave me a really good lecture, which I...
I was all proud that I'd given someone a good tip, and now it turns out it was a lecture.
Carried it with me, because I think that was my first or my second? I think it could have been my second
year,
Edinburgh.
I think,
And it was about not reading reviews. And when someone tags you on Twitter saying, here's a 2-star review of Jess Robinson or something, and they've tagged you, or here's a review of Jess Robinson, you said to write back, thank you so much. Thanks for coming to the show. I don't read reviews. And so I tried to do that from then. Last year, this last Edinburgh, I think I got it right.
Excellent. Excellent.
And that was making my niece, who's 16, take over my social media for the whole of Edinburgh.
Oh,
and
well
I didn't
done.
Look at it.
Well done.
But I had to be really disciplined and it's hard.
I may have said on the show before, like the level, I'm at level 3 at the moment, which is I don't read anyone's reviews, including my own or anyone else's.
Right.
Level 4 is doing that and not telling everyone that that's what you're doing. Oh, like at the moment I'm walking around going, hey guys, I don't read reviews. You know, which has the same seeds of anxiety in it.
Oh no, it's like picking a scab, isn't it? It's still quite tempting.
Mm-hmm.
But
so that's okay. So that's a lecture that I've given one or two people. That's funny. That
no, it was very freeing this last time.
Yeah. I'm glad because they're not for us, right?
Yeah,
they're not for us. And adding people in the reviews, I often think, is an attempt to. I mean, obviously, from the point of view of the person producing the review, they simply want their work to be retweeted. They want their thing to be read. But from our point of view, it can only feel like it's a they want something emotionally from us. Like, by all means, get it read, but don't send it to me. I don't want to read your appraisal. You don't want to have someone walk up to you in the street and go, oh, just... It's like the person after a gig who says, oh, I saw you last night, and you turn around smiling, like, yeah. And they go, yeah, I preferred that other person. You know, why would you say that to
my friend?
Okay, so the point I was coming to is that what you do is spectacular.
Is it?
Yeah, and you know that it is. Like, you are a standing ovation act, right? Like, generally, in life. You're the sort of person who, when you do your thing that you do, people get to their feet and go, Jesus Christ, I've never seen anything like that before. I mean, you can't deny that that has happened once or twice.
That has definitely happened, and that's incredible, but I still, and that's great, and I've got that skill to sing and to impersonate and to make people laugh that way and surprise people. But the idea of just standing at a microphone and telling jokes scares me shitless. I don't think I could do it.
Okay. What is the closest you've come to doing that? Because you talk to the audience.
Oh, I do the talkings. I call it talkings.
Yeah. and you're not, when you're doing genuinely brilliant celebrity impressions of very specific singers singing, you're not simply doing an impersonation of them.
I don't know what to observe about them.
Exactly. Yeah. It is.
Down how it works. And
exactly
yeah.
right. It's a. I hate it when people refer to stand up as a sketch. Do you know what I mean? Because it isn't that. But you are. Very specifically highlighting what's absurd about them. It's a vocal caricature.
Yeah, I'm just being an arsehole.
Let's call it that. Now we're on the same page. So there is a lot I think that we can talk about the decisions you make when you're doing that, about the places where those ideas come to you from that are effectively stand-up comedy in a different set of clothes.
Yeah, right? Okay. This is good. This is just like a therapy session boost for me. I'm liking this. Thank you.
Good. Well, tell me first then, before we get to the impressions, tell me about the talkings. Tell me about the talky bits that you do in between.
Well, they've all been quite different. I guess my most comfortable talky bits are when I'm explaining what's funny about Paloma Faith's voice. And, the way she speaks is like a little baby, a little girl who's had acid or something. It's like she's so weird and peculiar. And when she sings, it's like a weird foghorn. So I like making those observations that people can pick up on. And if it's Julie Andrews, the way she sings and the way she speaks are exactly the same. You're not surprised, but you're surprised when Paloma Faith's voice comes out.
Yes, gotcha.
And you're surprised when Adele's voice comes out, her singing voice, because she speaks like she could sell you a sausage roll in a pub, and she's got that ridiculous laugh. So I like doing that sort of thing. I talk about that until the cows come home. The slightly, probably cliche show that I did, but which really helped me and got me noticed a little bit, was my show the year before last about my divorce and about everything that broke down and how it all broke down and all of that sort of stuff. And I'm sure like loads of Sarah Pascoe and
John Robbins.
I know you said Robin Morgan. No. John Robbins. Yeah, they did their breakup shows, didn't they, this year? And it was a good way to deal with it. And I could have gone further. I could have told them everything. But I didn't. But yeah, so that was quite easy to talk about. But it was really fresh and I was dealing with it at the same time. And so some nights I really wanted to talk about it and other nights I just wanted to forget about it. But I decided to do a show and talk everybody through what had happened and how I was feeling. And that just, in the end, was just like, oh, fucking hell.
Now, I didn't see that show. I'm assuming that whilst talking about it, there was a lot of singing.
There was lots of singing.
So it's not simply a spoken word kind of, this is my...
No, but there were big chunks of quite sort of vulnerable stuff.
So you said there that you could have gone deeper, but you didn't. So why didn't you?
I think I just didn't want to out him to everyone.
Okay.
Like, about him, but I didn't want to make it about him. I wanted to talk about me, but then it... Oh, it's hard doing those sort of shows, actually. And part of me sort of cringes at it, and another part of me is glad that I did it, but it's quite a vulnerable place to put yourself in, and it's quite a cliche thing to do and quite sort of cringy, isn't it? I'm just going around in circles, talking.
No. I think there is definitely something interesting about the performer's desire, and specifically in your case, the performer's desire, someone who on stage has got a lot of things you can do besides simply talk about your feelings.
Yeah, I hadn't done anything like that before.
Sure. And there must have been, I mean, presumably there was something attractive to you in going, well, actually I can use this space on stage to do something else besides my amazing, I was going to call it showing off there, but I don't mean it.
It's like a girl in a party dress.
Absolutely. So it was in your first show where you had the two wheels.
Yeah, the wheels of 60 fortunes. Yeah,
great. So you had all these different, styles and different.
Eight different artists. Celebrities on one, eight different songs on the other.
Yes.
And we'd spin them and so Shirley Bassey would sing Ace of Spades. Or...
Great. And any version of that happened, you were completely comfortable with. And it was, like you said, a girl in a party dress. It had this kind of party trick feel to it. You are so comfortable in your ability to do something, not just to fulfil the brief of A meets X.
Yeah.
But also to make it fresh every time, to make yourself laugh, to make Kirsty Newton, who was playing the piano for you.
Yeah,
you know, that you'd be in fits of giggles because you were coming up with these sort of...
Oh, it was great fun, yeah.
I mean, it sounds fantastic. So you could presumably have done that kind of thing for the rest of your career.
People were disappointed that the wheels didn't come back.
I've got to say. How did that feel, that they were disappointed, that you were like, I'm doing my meaningful show, and they're like, bring back the wheels.
Well... luckily, for light relief in the divorce show, as we'll call it, we did have Natalie Cassidy's ball bag in that. So she had a bag full of balls with different songs and things on. But I loved the wheels, but it felt like... It always feels with Edinburgh like you have to come back reinvented each year and not do just the same crowd-pleasing stuff. I don't know, it feels funny in that way. I kept trying to push myself to do different things and to raise it and to keep raising the level and raising the bar each time, which is how I got to talking, you know, like talking about divorce and shit like that. It's like showing everyone your pants, isn't it?
I'm interested in the genesis of that idea to do that divorce show. Was it a case of you feeling like you had to do something like that in order to have reinvented yourself, in order to not necessarily to please Edinburgh, but to fit the expectations of Edinburgh?
Yeah.
Was there a sense that something was expected of you as a, like, once you've gone up there and taken the roof off with this smash hit show? I remember the posters everywhere, and you know, it was like a landing, bang, this is a new thing we should all be aware of.
Yeah, but you know, that was also a thing like, oh, let's put big posters up so people think I'm a person before I actually am.
Yeah, of course, and that's the game that everyone participates in, but equally, you can put a load of big posters up there and not have people on their feet applauding. Do you know what I mean? Like, you seem to fit the...
Yeah.
Oh, you know, the worst case scenario in this is that, God, your brand identity's great. Do you know what I mean? Like, she can't deliver the goods at all, but whoa, you think? And I don't think we're in that sort of territory.
Yeah, okay.
Right? So once there is this idea that, bang, year one, you know, explosive, year two, explosive, was there a sense for you that in year three, I'm just wondering where it came from, did you think, I've got to get on there and talk about my divorce?
Mm.
Or did you think, I have to do something else, and it seems appropriate to Edinburgh to dig deeper. How much? 60-40? Where were you on it?
Well, my director for that show was lovely Rohan Acharya, yep. who'd done my first two shows as well. And when we were talking about the third Edinburgh, I think all of the stuff was going on. I'd literally just left him and stuff. And so Ro was saying, okay, so let's just think, I just want you to write about all the things you're thinking about at the moment. What have you been thinking about this year? And all I could say was, the divorce. So that was it. That's all I could think about. So I thought, fuck him, fuck this. I'm going to make this the best show I've ever done. And fuck you. I think it came from anger as well. I'm moving on. This is in my rearview mirror and I'm going to do a fucking amazing show about it. But is that just a bit indulgent, isn't it?
Well, absolutely not. I mean, no more so than any of us. You know, let's assume that we're all self-indulgent to a certain extent. Let's assume that we all want to get up there.
Isn't it? Yeah. Show off in our party dresses.
So... That's interesting. So was it a case maybe that it was too fresh for you to be able to, for you to have the tools to talk about it? Like the event had just happened.
When I was talking to my mates about it.
I don't know the material facts of it because I didn't see that show, but you got divorced. How long were you married? I
mean, 18 months. Okay, so fine. I was married for 18 months together with him for about 8 years. And then, oh my God, big things came out that I didn't know about. A whole double life was going on.
Okay.
Some internet stuff that I didn't know about, kind of gross, dark stuff. And yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Which I can't talk about too much because his mum still doesn't know. Whoopsies. So.
Okay.
But So I was talking to my friends about it and it was all very fresh and they were like, Jess, I just feel like this is a show that you could do maybe in a year. This is like not the show you should be doing now. But everybody, you know, I was determined.
How do you feel now, a couple of years since that? How do you think you could do that show justice or more justice now?
I think I might go further now into telling the stories, but no, I don't think so. I think that was a show for then and I don't want to do it now. And I guess I'm glad I did it then. And so this last Edinburgh, I was like, well, I'm just going to have fun. I'm just going to do my favourite thing. I'm not going to try and reinvent the wheels of 64 tunes or reinvent the wheels. I'm just going to have a lovely time with my band. And that's what I did. And it was a really simple, just feel-good, fun show.
Let's talk about the feel-good, fun stuff. Let's talk about the voices. When did you first become aware that you could nail a singing impression of someone?
So at school, this is going to be like the story that everybody has
told. I know, they're all very different. They're all very different.
I was not popular. I was not a pretty girl. I didn't have boyfriends. I was just a bit of a dweeb.
And what is this school? What's the school about? Because am I right in thinking you were a stage school?
Yeah.
I have no experience of that. I don't know what that's like at all.
My mum is a pianist and she ran the secondhand shop there, shop.
Okay.
And I was really frightened of going to normal state school because I thought it would be like Grange Hill and a few people told me I would get my head flushed down the toilet and my trainers cut up, and mum was there playing the piano, so I auditioned. I could sing. I always was good at singing, so I auditioned for this school and I got a music scholarship and I went there, and I never wanted to be a performer. I wanted to be a vet.
What? And you literally started this by going, oh, it's the same old story. And I don't think I've ever heard of anyone go to stage school. I mean, maybe I don't know many stage school or any stage school people, but you went to stage school because you were scared of real school.
Yeah. Yeah.
And didn't actually want to be a performer.
No, I didn't.
Did you have a feeling that anyone else was in that same boat with you? Or was everyone there a kind of what we might imagine to be the stage school cliche of like, everyone wants to play Annie? Is that a cliche or not?
It wasn't like Fame, but yeah, there was, I mean, lots of, it was really a known for its ballet and its dancing, and I am shit. The teachers hated me. I've got inside-out arms and sway-back legs and flat feet and... no. So I was there on the theatre course, which was like a course for duds. This is from the age of 9 to 18. I was just there fannying around. Lots of people really wanted to be serious ballet dancers. There were lots of anorexic people there, and sort of people that were quite unhealthy. It was a weird place to sort of become a person.
It must have been. I mean, I suppose that idea of like, and I mean, I don't know much about anorexia, but I suppose the culture of a stage school environment must be a very weird place to be a kid. I mean, I certainly...
It's bad for your body image, that's for sure. Yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah, it's not... But then, so is everything at the moment. Magazines and all of that stuff.
Yeah. I remember from... I went to a drama school for a year, or 9 months. I did like a postgrad degree. And I remember thinking, with no reflection to the particular one that I went to, but I remember thinking the whole idea of a drama school, even one for like, you know, 18 to 21 year olds, whatever, is a bit mad because there isn't enough work for all the supply that you're creating.
Yeah.
There's not enough demand. And I would imagine with stage schools as well, there's not every kid that comes out of stage school is going to get a job.
I'm the only one in my year that's working. I think most people gave up in the first few years.
Having had your whole childhood geared around success and an arguably, not an impossible dream, but an incredibly unlikely dream. Whereas I suppose if you go to a regular school and they say, you know, one day you could be a teacher or a whatever, or a banker or a lawyer, whatever you want, then, there's lots. I mean, I'm not saying it's easy to achieve those things, but there are opportunities rather than one day you can be one of a million people auditioning for one role.
Yeah. I mean, don't get me wrong. I had the best time. It was like being at a constant summer camp or something.
Okay.
It was fun. There were bitchy people there and the dance teachers were hideous. But it was really fun. But I was still determined at the age of 18 when I left that I had a place at Bristol University to do a music degree. And I was determined that that's what I was going to do. And I would be a film composer or maybe a session singer or something like that. I was going to do something like that.
Okay. And then, which is sort of the opposite of the starring. That's like you went there, you didn't want to be a performer. And something changed whereby you went, well, there's an opportunity for actual, presumably there's work as session singers.
Yeah.
More readily available.
Yeah, and I think it's decent money.
Getting a job as a star.
absolutely. But we did a show at school and I think the drama teacher was sort of probably railroaded by my mum into giving me a decent role because I'd been there for so long. And there happened to be an agent in that night who said to me, why don't you defer your place for a year? And why don't you, you know, come on the books and let's see what happens.
Okay, so what happened?
So at that point, I thought, oh, okay, maybe I should. So I got a job on Oxford Street in the stockroom in a clothes shop called Morgan at the age of 18. Moved to a hostel with my friend Kirsty, who was a ballet dancer. We hadn't ever been friends at school, actually. She was a little Yorkshire redhead girl, and my earliest memory of her was her asking me not to sit on her bed with a bare bottom. little random story for you there. So we moved to London. She got a job in a bar. I got a job at this this shop on Oxford Street in the stockroom. And I auditioned for a pantomime and I got the part of Snow White at the Shaw Theatre in Euston. And even then, after that, I was like, no, I don't like it. I don't like the dancers in the cast. They are bitches. I don't want to spend my life doing this. This is awful. But then the director said, do you want to come and play Dorothy in The Wizard of Oz in Western Supermare?
every girl's dream.
So I went to Western Supermare and I played Dorothy. And then I think I got another job out of that. And I just slowly just started working. And then when it was time to nearly confirm Bristol again, I deferred it another year. Ooh. And then I never went. So I've just been a wanker since I was born, really.
Well, what is it that you... When you say I've been a wanker since I was born, what tactic are you trying to do conversationally?
I don't know.
Come on. Listen, like, you're...
I fell into the impressions
You're embarrassed to have been successful.
I've been really, really lucky. I have been successful, but I've been fucking lucky. And I've been a big old liar as well. I got into impressions because I was doing another pantomime in Hereford, and the director said that there was a production of Little Voice coming up, and I did not want to go back to the stockroom. And so I said, I'm absolutely amazing at impressions. I'm really good. Please, can I audition? And she said, yes, it's in 10 days then. So then I was like, fuck, shit, fuck, wank. And I had to, excuse my language, it's terrible. And I learnt. And luckily I could sing. So I learnt how to, I had a cassette tape of Judy Garland and Marilyn Monroe and all of that. And I would listen to them, then record myself on my dictaphone, play it back. And I managed to do it and I got the job. And that's how I got into impressions.
Okay.
I never meant to do any of this.
Okay. So you're, I mean, you, do you feel you have a natural gift for impressions or do you feel you have a gift for blagging it under pressure? What's your...
Both.
Okay.
The blagging it under pressure came first. Did it? Maybe. I did do Kate Bush impressions at school and I did impressions of the teachers to make people laugh. That was my currency in school, just being a bit of a clown and a bit of an idiot and getting by that way and getting friends. But I would never get invited on the holidays to Greece that all the girls would go on, of the pretty girls. So I would instead go and do a recorder course.
Okay.
Or a choir course.
Uh-huh.
Okay. Such a geek. I was in a recorder club called Oh Blow It. We did competitions and everything.
So this is Jess. We'll get right back to this very soon. I've got a couple of little updates for you. The tour is continuing to sell in a very encouraging way. If you would like to come and see me do stand-up on tour, if you'd like to come and see Like I Mean It, which was my Edinburgh show from 2017 and was one of the top 20 best reviewed shows at the Edinburgh Festival, then you can come along at a town near you. All details available from comedianscomedian.com/tour. And it is so, so exciting to see tickets selling and to know that on this, my third tour, to be fairly confident of having a big load of you turn up and talk to me afterwards and be part of the crowd and part of the experience. And I think everyone who's come to see it on the basis of enjoying the podcast and enjoying these conversations I had and then taking a punt on me as a stand-up comedian, I've had such positive feedback from you all. It's great. I'm going to talk a little bit more about at the end of the show about some of the things I have to be thankful for, but if you are one of those people who thinks, hey, he can talk, he can listen, but can he stand up? Come and find out. It's comedianscomedian.com/tour, so get along to that. Thank you for your donations. I want to say thank you in particular to Robert, Kevin, Danny, Mike and Peter, who all donated this week. And thank you to Alexander as well for a big emotional email, which I will read an extract from at the end of this podcast because it's brilliant and it made me really happy, so listen out to that. And if you are wanting to donate yourself, if you're enjoying the show and you would like to give something back, then you can go to comedianscomedian.com/donate. That's comedianscomedian.com/donate. You can support the show with a recurring, regular donation of however much you like, or you can make a one-off donation, or if you don't fancy PayPal, you can use Moonclerk and Patreon and all those other things. Now, I wanted to talk very quickly about the Facebook group. There are over 5,500, sort of getting on for 6,000 people in that, and that is a really good place to talk to other kindred spirits, to talk to other members of the Comedians Comedian Podcast. I mean, I'm just going to start shortening it to ComCom Pod now because it's too much of a mouthful. Other members of the ComCom community. And you can ask and answer questions such as, what are your questions for when James Acaster returns? That episode's going to be released mid-January and I'm having that conversation with James in a couple of days from now. So you might not have the chance to get in for that one, but you can be in with a chance of getting one of your questions asked of forthcoming guests in future, but also people have been asking each other stuff in a really inspiring and encouraging way. Someone asked, where's the best place to start with Maria Bamford, and some very helpful suggestions there, a very good use of the group. I linked to a list of the best books for aspiring comedians, to which I contributed myself a few curveballs, and it's a really fun list as well. And then someone asked the following question. He's writing a paper, and he said, would you say that Lee and Herring were part of the lad culture of the 1990s? And there were some brilliant, really well-thought-out responses. And then somewhere down the list, there was a brilliant, well-thought-out response from Mr. Richard Herring himself, which was lovely to see and really exciting to kind of go, there we go, there's a quotable source for your essay. And also, you'll remember the haiku competition from last week's episode, which I will announce the winner of probably next time I speak to you. I'll let that run for a little while longer. And after the mention of haikus on the show, in the Facebook group, David Braziel proffered the following haiku, not as part of the competition, but just for fun. And his is this: in the ice and snow, we turn into Ed Sheeran and walk gingerly. Very nice. I thought it was very nice. Everybody joined in, and there's loads of them up there, of which I can't read them all out now, but my favourite is from Tom Davies, and he said, ComComPod is the place I don't get asked to buy mattresses each time. Bang! That is absolutely fantastic. Love your work, Tom, and thank you, David. Love your work also. So I've mentioned the donors, and I've mentioned, yes, a big emotional email from Alexander, which I will get into at the postamble at the end of this episode. Now, let's get back to Jess Robinson.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
This moment of going, right, I've committed to an audition for something, I've said that I can do impressions, and I've got next to no experience of doing them.
Yeah.
Sitting down with a tape recorder and playing stuff back and forth, this is a while ago, because probably impressionists now use YouTube.
Yeah.
In a kind of, I mean, that must be a gift exactly. To an impressionist.
Yeah, yeah. I didn't have a laptop or anything. There wasn't a computer in the house or anything.
Okay. So you're listening to stuff, playing it back, and not just copying it. Well, were you? Were you pastiching people when you did the little voice audition?
No, I was properly trying to do it, you know, parrot fashion, learning their voice the way they sang these songs.
Okay. And you presumably got the part?
Yeah.
So, having fallen into all of these things, or sort of a combination of falling into things and then deciding you actually quite like it.
Yeah.
How do you then come from that to Edinburgh?
So, once I did Little Voice, it so happened that the woman playing my mum was friends with Bill Dare, who was the producer of Dead Ringers. Uh-huh. And she said, why don't you send your tape to Bill? So I sent him a recording of me doing Judy Garland and Marilyn Monroe, and he was like, oh, it's very good, but we don't really have much call for Judy Garland on Dead Ringers. So, but then I wrote back and said, oh, well, I do lots of speaking impressions too. It's another fucking lie. Never. Hadn't even thought about it. Never dreamt of doing anything like that. And then I got an audition to go in and meet him and Caroline Norris, who were working on Dead Ringers. And so then I learnt again. I learnt Fizz from Coronation Street. I learnt Natalie Cassidy from EastEnders. I learnt some Desperate Housewives and stuff like that. I went in and they liked it. And then a couple of days later, I got a call from the director saying, can you do the woman from Desperate Housewives? So I said, yes. And he said, but the only thing is you've got to be able to roller skate. And I went, I'm brilliant at roller skating. That's fine. And, you know, the next day I was at the roller disco with 13 and 14-year-old at my local sports centre going round and round and getting one of the stewards, who was like a spotty 15-year-old, to tell me how to stop. it's lies.
Okay. So you're... What I'm trying to get my head round is like what when they said we don't have much call for Judy Garland, but actually there's an audition for someone who can do voices.
Yeah.
And you said, oh, that's me. Where does that come from? Did you desperately want to do that job? Did you need the money? Were you excited by the idea of performing, of being something on TV or radio? What was it that led you to tell these, in the end, very effective lies?
Terrible lies. I think... God, that's a really good question. I don't know, because I don't think I'm an arrogant person, and I'm so worried all the time about what people think of me. Will people like me? Do they think I've made the right decision? All of that. I'm, you know, really, it's quite pathetic. And I do know my limits. Like, if someone said, could you be a ballet dancer, come and do this, you know, I would say no. I know I couldn't. But I've always just thought, oh, I could probably do that. Yeah, no, I can probably do that. Well, how hard is it to, you know, move around on wheels? I'm sure it'd be fun. So I just said yes and just, I don't know, hope for the best. I don't know where it came from. Recklessness, I think. A reckless need to please.
Well, let's...
And prove myself. I'm glad you said that.
Let's talk about that, because I think that forms the kind of the genetic makeup of a lot of performers and comics and actors and okay. whoever. This idea of a need to please. Because you seem to have a really interesting combination of innate ability, talent, or you know, talent, the same thing maybe, skill... Mm. And the ability to learn quickly.
Yeah.
Apparently.
Yeah. Who knew?
And you've got all of these skills, and yet you still feel, it seems, like you... Do you feel powerful or do you feel vulnerable? Let's look at it that way. Well, okay. How come you feel so vulnerable, given your ability to do the job, to walk out of drama school and get jobs, to be the main part in one thing after another, to ace an audition, blag it in the last 10 minutes... Like, why do you still feel vulnerable?
Because but this is like everybody, isn't it? I'd feel I can be found out at any second and it can be taken away, and then what will I be left with?
What would you be left with?
Well, I guess I could go to Bristol and do my music degree.
Yeah.
I don't know, but I've lost all my skills now. I can't even play the violin anymore. Not that I could. But, I'm having a nice time. I'm having a lovely time. And I feel so lucky. And I just feel like I'm always hanging on by the skin of my teeth, but, you know, flying by the seat of my pants, all those cliches, I think. So, and I just feel like this need to constantly prove myself and make people see that it's okay and I can really do it, and isn't it good, and you know, I don't know.
Where do you think that comes from?
My mother. I don't know. Where does it come from? It might come from my childhood. It might come from that competitive nature in school, where even when I was at my little village school, we had to dance around the maypole by the village pond and the stocks that were there. I always had to be the boy. So I don't... No, that's not a thing. Shut up. I don't know.
What do you mean it's not a thing?
Well, I don't know. I never got to...
Did you always have to be the boy in the
maypole?
Yeah,
I did always have to be the boy.
Why? Who made
I had brown
you be
hair.
The boy? Okay.
And I wasn't all pretty and blonde. So I had to be the boy. And then... Oh, God, I don't know what I'm saying, really. I'm just gabbling like a twit. I don't know. And I guess maybe growing up in that atmosphere at school where everybody so wanted to be a star and everybody wanted to make it, and I had to really, 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 really work to get noticed and to get any credit for what I was doing, and to, I don't know, be popular or be included, or I don't know. Maybe it's
would
that.
Would you send your own hypothetical child to a stage school?
No, I don't think I would. Listen to me, I'm dreadfully neurotic. I don't know. No, I don't know. I don't know if I'm going to have children. I think I might have a dog, but I'm frightened I'd leave it in a bar. Would I send my own hypothetical child to stage call?
I'm just going to interrupt here because I feel like you, a couple of times, you've nearly said something honest or vulnerable.
Ooh!
And then you've made a little joke of it and pulled back.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Let's talk about that because my audience, the people who listen to this, I think one of the reasons they listen to this is they want the real thing. And I think you are, and it would be lazy to equate this with the fact that you're an impressionist and that you do other people and stuff. You know, one of the things that stand-ups that we always get is like, oh, are you secretly miserable? Is it the tears of a clown? Presumably there's some equivalent cliche for impressionists. So it'd be like, who is the real you?
Oh,
do you know what I mean?
Neurotic, depressed, anxious person, definitely.
Okay. Well, can we talk about that? Because whenever we get close to it, you do a little giggle and a little head shake.
But what if I cry or something?
You can cry. People have cried on this before. And, you know, I'm not a therapist and this isn't therapy. But I feel like you are holding back from being honest about things. And I feel like you are kind of glitzing your way out of a couple of questions.
Yes, probably.
Does that resonate for you? Do you think that... So what's that about?
Here we go. I think I just want to prove that I'm good enough all the time. I think I didn't feel good enough.
Good enough for what?
Good enough to be where I was, or good enough to... I feel like, I guess my childhood, I had a great childhood, don't get me wrong, but maybe it was a constant fight to prove myself and to succeed and to... Yeah, I don't know really. I think I've never been comfortable with who I am. Or I want people to like who I am because maybe I've never quite been comfortable in my own skin. I don't know. I might be making all of this up.
Well, when you just said at the end that I might be making all of this up, that's exactly the sort of thing I was talking about. But thank you. Thank you for... I'm not a therapist. I don't want to make you cry for the sake of making you cry. But I am... I think... The reason I do this is because I've been through a lot of those things myself, and I feel like I recognise that aspect of it a bit in you.
Mm.
And maybe there is a difference between the way we do our work, whereby, you know, stand-up comedians, we've sort of some of us relentlessly self-analyse, and it's all about bearing your guts on stage, in a way that maybe it's not fair of me to kind of push you on this stuff because...
No, it's fine.
So that feeling of wanting people to know that you're enough, I can definitely relate to that.
Mm.
Feeling like I've got to do this because if I don't do this, then it'll all come crashing down, in air quotes, in some kind of...
I want to do it. I want to do it right. I want people to think that I'm doing it right. I want to... Everything, I think... I get exhausted because everything always feels like a constant fight, a constant battle. I'm constantly trying to move forward.
A battle against the circumstances or a battle against the negative voices that you have? Like, is it a battle against the outside world or is it a battle against the self?
It's probably against myself. I just want to prove myself. I don't know where that comes from. I don't want to fail and I don't want to give up. But if I could... You know, if there was a cartoon with me, it would be me with boxing gloves on against the whole world, I think.
Absolutely. And I completely empathise with that. Someone sent me an email in regard to something I said at the end of the last show, where I finish this show every time with a bit of a reflection on what I'm up to at the moment, what I'm feeling and thinking. And I finished it by saying, oh, I've been a bit anxious recently. And I've kind of fallen back into that anxiety, and I finished the postamble by saying, you're not as bad as you think you are. And someone, like to the people listening, and someone emailed and said, thank you. I burst into tears at that point. And that made me think that was always a big trigger for me to recognise when I was getting too anxious to function or recognise I was getting depressed, was when anyone ever said to me, it's all going to be okay, I'd start crying. Because yeah. I mean, there was some sort of unclenching. There was like,
yeah, God.
I'd like that. That feeling of wanting to be enough. It sounds like from you, if you sort of see yourself as the little girl with boxing gloves, it feels like from the things you've described happening to you that the world isn't against you. The world is quite happy to sort of welcome you in and give you opportunities and things like
that. This is
true.
I think nothing's fallen in my lap. I think I've had to work hard for stuff. But also there have been really like just weird lucky breaks and big lies as well.
Sure. And that's one of the boxing gloves, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely.
Telling the right lie at the right time.
Yeah, sure.
So how is your happiness generally at the moment? When you get a standing ovation, is that enough? Does that feel like enough? And for how long does that feel like enough?
It feels like enough for maybe 5-10 minutes, half an hour, until the next show. And then I'm starting again, I guess. How is my happiness? I like to come across as being extremely happy, bubbly, you know, keep your head down, be lovely to work with, be lovely to everyone, always work hard and all of that sort of stuff. I don't know how happy I am. I think I am. I think there's a big, big bit of unhappiness in me, actually. Yeah. I don't know where it comes from, though.
Have you ever had therapy?
Yeah. Therapy. I'm on citalopram, which is like an antidepressant, anti-anxiety thing, which for me, I feel just, it doesn't stop the unhappiness. It just helps me function. I think it's pretty low dose, but I like to have it with me. Yeah.
I know that you...
I shouldn't be unhappy, though, because I've got lovely things in my life, wonderful friends.
Shouldn't is a big therapy word, is it?
Yeah.
You know, I absolutely remember that. I should do this. I should do this more. I get that with this podcast. I should put more work into it. I should promote. I should do this. I want it to be bigger because I've got a thing now.
Yeah.
I've got a thing that makes people stand up and clap. And I'm like, oh, God, you know, often in the bath or they're walking the dog. But I it's a real battle for me to let this podcast remain a joyous thing in my life and not another thing I can turn into a difficult challenge.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? It's like, oh, here's a nice thing. How can I turn this against myself? How can I turn this into a stick with which to beat myself? you're laughing at that. Does that resonate with you? Do you think?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I get that. I think I put a lot of pressure on myself. And I'm very picky about, you know, what I do. I feel like I'm lazy a lot of the time, which is a really weird thing. So I'll often think, I haven't worked on that voice enough. I could do it so much better. She does it much better than I do. Or they're going to think I'm copying, or, you know, I just worry the whole time that I'm not good enough and I've been lazy by not working hard enough. Which is silly with my boxing gloves on, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, that's it. I suppose the sort of the awful, the tension within it is you work really hard and beat yourself up to work really, one beats oneself up to work really hard and then achieves a certain amount of success And that's like proof that beating yourself up works.
Yeah.
But what if I stop beating myself up? I won't have the nice opportunities and exciting jobs and, you know.
Yeah.
Big lighting backdrops and all that, you know, the rest of the...
It is fun, though. I mean, the performing is wonderful. It's super fun. Most of the time.
Let's talk about the thing at which you really excel. Let's talk about the voices and the songs and the rhythm and the flow and the making it all work. You said then, and this does slightly come back to it, but you said then that you see other people who do that sort of thing and go, oh, why can't I do it like them? What to you makes a brilliant impression or a characterisation? What is it?
For me, it's picking up on the nuances, the funny things that when someone that doesn't do that sort of thing can look at it and go, oh my God, that's so funny. Yeah, she does do that. Like, just picking up on those little hooks. There's with the Nicola Sturgeon, she's got this slightly wobbly head. Or I don't know, like the facial expressions that Nicki Minaj does, or the with Bjork, her voice.
I've never heard your Bjork. Can you? Someone I've read in lots of reviews have mentioned your Bjork, and I've never actually heard you do Bjork.
So Bjork has got this sort of. We've got the eyes. It's all so quiet. All of that sort of stuff. But she's got this hooty way of singing, and then this whaley thing. Like, it's all of these different things in her voice, which just makes it sound like I'm being murdered. Yeah, I've been listening to lots of Bjork recently. I'm doing some music videos at the moment. It's just a little project that I've decided to do where I'm going to do some videos with some unlikely duets between people. So I've got Bjork and Lady Gaga collaborating. I've got Kate Bush and Gaga, Nicki Minaj and Billie Holiday. Lots of, and I'm just going to release them slowly and do, you know, film it with split screen and fun things like that, which has just been a really exciting, fun little project, just because I feel like I need more stuff out there on YouTube. Everyone's on YouTube and I don't have much stuff out there. So... Yeah, so so listening to Bjork, and I love her. She's so weird.
It sounds to me like what you're going for with the impressions is basically it's observational comedy, isn't it? It's noticing things that people haven't noticed that they've noticed.
Exactly.
You know what I mean?
That's
so
exactly
so when
right.
you do it, the audience goes, oh, I didn't even... Yeah,
yeah,
right.
yeah, of course, like, she does that, yeah.
Okay, so you're an observational comic.
Am I?
Yeah.
Cool.
I have
a certificate.
Yeah. There is no certificate.
I really want some certificates to go on my wall, please.
If there is a certificate, it comes with like a debt of $5,000. You're in the gang now.
Yeah, I guess so. That's interesting. I'd never thought of that.
Yeah, I think that's true. So you take those observations and then you put them in a form which allows you to bounce from one observation to another.
Yeah.
So it's effectively, it's not a million miles away from a Michael McIntyre bit about a mandrel, where you go, there's this thing, and here's an idea about it, here's an idea about it. But you're also doing it, in inverted commas, backwards and in high heels, aren't you? You know, you're also singing.
Yeah.
So there's a kind of an underlying...
With me, the singing from when I was, just all my life, but particularly, I guess, from about 9 or 10, when I started having singing lessons, singing is the best thing in the world. That is the thing that I love, 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 love the most. I like getting laughs as well. I love getting laughs. But singing just makes me feel alive. I love it so much.
I mean, I have to say, someone asked me years ago, what superpower would you have? We were having this conversation. I think I'd like to be able to sing really brilliantly. They're like, what, you could fly? And I'm like, they say, you could learn to sing? I'm like, yeah, I don't want to have to learn to sing. I just, you know, I'm singing in the shower, or I'll sing to my son, you know. And I know I'm bad. I can see my wife wincing and I don't understand what a key is and all that. You know what I mean? It's sort of disastrous. I had some key negative learning experiences as a kid about my ability or otherwise to sing. But I love it. And that idea of being able of like having your whole body like a tuning fork where you just like everything resonates.
Yeah.
And you go, pow. Like
yeah.
That. And that's, and I think people, obviously, in your audiences respond enormously to that, because it's a really primal kind of a thing. When you are building a show, when you have those big ideas, like the like YouTube stuff, kind of split screen stuff. I remember you did at this Waverley Care show we did, you did, is it One Voice?
Yeah.
Was it My Voice or One Voice?
One Voice. And then at the end, this is the sound of my voice.
Yes.
Yeah.
Just describe to us what that is and let's look at how that came to be.
So it was actually my lovely musical director, Alex Silverman, who found this beautiful folk song by, I think they're called the Spinning Jennies. And it's, this is the sound of one voice, and it's just one voice singing. And then another voice joins. This is the sound of voices too, the sound of me singing with you. And then there's the third verse is, this is the sound of voices three, singing together in harmony. And then the fourth verse is, this is the sound of all of us singing together, or sing something with the will to trust. And then it goes back to one voice. And Alex said, why don't you do that in your own voice and say, this is the sound of my voice. So the way we adapted it was we had Billie Holiday singing the first verse. This is the sound of one voice, the sound of one who makes a choice. And then the second verse was, I think we joined by, with Amy Winehouse. This is the sound of voices too. And we had Billie Holiday singing in harmony with her. So it was gorgeous. And then Kate Bush joined in on verse three. This is the sound of voices three. Like, all silly and squeaky. We added a bit of Catherine Jenkins in there for a bit of opera, and then Beyonce joined in, and it just swelled to this massive thing. So I was singing in harmony with myself and in my ultimate girl band, basically, of all my favourite voices. And then it just dropped down to just piano and me. This is the sound of my voice. And it would always choke me up because it felt really vulnerable.
And what... when you say it felt really vulnerable, you mean specifically the bit at the end?
Yeah.
Just your voice?
Yeah.
Because it is, I mean, it's like a brilliant musical version of that Mike Yarwood and This Is Me.
Yeah.
Do you remember, like, I don't know if I ever saw that, but I'm aware that it exists,
yes,
as a thing.
Yes, exactly.
He'd do a load of impressions, then he'd say, This Is Me.
Yeah.
So that vulnerability of just singing as yourself, does that feel qualitatively different on stage to be singing as you?
Yeah. Really, really does. Mums always go, why don't you sing in your own voice? She hates the impression. She'd much rather I just sung in my own voice for a whole concert or something. And maybe I will one day, who knows? I love singing in my own voice, but I don't think, like, I just don't think it's very distinctive, very special. Mum would disagree.
Well, it's certainly not going to have the reaction as ripping out a brilliant Billie Holiday.
No.
Because that has kind of... you're clearly singing brilliantly and there's this other quality to it.
Yeah, exactly.
So I suppose my question is, do you... like, in terms of whether you'd want to do an hour of just your voice, is your successful ability to mimic other people's voices something of a cage?
Yeah. Yeah, in a way it is. Yeah, it is. I don't know who'd turn up to hear me just singing on my own. Although I would really love to do that one day, you know, with all of these, even if I just listen to a Kate Bush album or a really lovely Anne La Havas, or I get really inspired and think, oh, I could just be a pop star, or not a pop star, but you know what I mean? Just be a musical artist in my own right. And would that ever happen? And who would come and see it? But I couldn't, but yeah.
Well, so, talk to me about that, because you are undoubtedly an artist in that, you, like we've said, you're kind of, you're making observations about people's voices, you're using your own ear as well as the being able to play the instrument of your voice incredibly well. But I am interested in, like, because I'm not a musician and I don't understand how it works when you play an existing piece of material, like a cover.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Like, do you, that has a satisfaction in itself, but I always imagine someone, like, you know, a busker playing a Bob Dylan number.
Yeah.
Is that busker thinking, I'd love to be the person rather than the person covering the person?
Yeah. I think everybody wants to be the person. I'd like to be the person. I'd like to, yeah.
Because I've never had an impressionist on the show before, and that's only just occurred to me, that aspect of...
Yeah.
Naturally, the job of an impressionist is to...
To be all the other people.
Mimic more successful people. In much the same way as the job of a podcaster is like, no one... Do you know what I mean? No one goes into podcasting because it's all going so well. Do you know what I mean? It's like, it's a thing you do as an additional... Like, you know, yeah. You have time to do it,
yeah.
Because you're not doing massive stratospheric stuff.
I'd like to be the person one day, yeah.
And how would you...
I've always wanted to be the person, and that's what I've probably always been fighting against, isn't it?
So to come back to that idea of the divorce show, that seems like that's the... Was that scratching that itch? Was that the beginning of a process of, like,
maybe.
Actually, this is me being the person?
Yeah, maybe.
And what you said at the beginning was you could have gone further, but you didn't. Do you need to go further in order to be the person?
Yeah, maybe. But who's it for? It's for me, not for the audience. They don't want to see that. They want to be entertained with Shirley Bassey rapping and things like that. Which
well,
is, like, don't get me wrong, that is fun.
They don't want to see that. Says who?
But then I don't know. But it could be so indulgent and awful and cringy and dreadful, and they'll be like, what are you doing? We just do the impressions. We came for the impressions. I don't want to hear you talking about, I don't know, mental health or your thighs. Also, I've always thought the impressions, and certainly the singing impressions, are what set me apart.
Yeah.
That's my USP.
Yeah.
So why on earth would I go out and talk about other stuff that other people are talking about just to make me feel better? I can do that with you.
Okay. Okay. Yeah. Good. Good answer. I mean, I think that is...
I mean, I might do that on Life Stories one day with Piers Morgan, you know. Although I'd rather not be in the same room as him.
I think the... I don't know. It's funny because I don't think it's not up to me to make pronouncements about.
But go on.
People's work. But I do think that's interesting that you. I think there is a tension at the heart of all performers, not just you. But I think in the terms of the conversation we're having here, I feel like there's a tension at the heart of what you do, where you want to be. I don't know.
Go on.
What do you think I'm going
to
say?
That you want to be the star, you want to be the one.
But it is, not specifically that, it's just that it's fascinating to me that you are the star and yet you are not the star because you're, do you know what I mean? That's
yeah.
fascinating to me.
Yeah.
Not in a way that you need to do anything about, or you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But I am interested in what that feels like to be raising the roof, getting a standing ovation, brilliantly taking off.
Mm.
An existing thing.
Yeah,
because
that's true.
Because when I tell a joke, it's my joke.
Yeah.
And when they like it, they like my performance of my joke.
Yeah.
And with you, it's not that it's different to that. They're loving your performance of your take on, you know, it's still your work. It's your observations
of the
person.
But it's about someone else,
but
isn't it?
There is someone else at the heart of it.
Yeah. I mean... I think about that a lot, actually. Sometimes I think, well, to all intents and purposes, I'm a tribute act, aren't I?
I see where you could come from that. I don't want to agree with that because that to me sounds like the Jess who's hitting herself with a stick. I mean, I don't want to agree with that version of you. But it is interesting to hear that.
If I don't do something different, if I don't mix it up or raise the bar or have something to say, then what? Yeah. I think I need to do that for my own, I don't know, yeah, for my own peace of mind, maybe. That sounds a bit daft, really.
So do you need, in order to achieve the happiness that you want and the career that you want, do you need to always be changing it up every year? Say it's a year at Edinburgh or a year at Vegas or wherever it is. Do you always need to be changing it? And is that daunting to think that there is a lifetime's worth of reinvention and constant reinvention ahead of you?
Yeah, that is daunting. That is very daunting. And I think, when will I know when it's enough? Because it's exhausting. It feels like it doesn't stop moving. Like, I've got the thing that I do. That's what I do for now. But, it never stops being a challenge. Or there's a little a little sort of opening medley of lots of impressions and things I do, and I've been doing it for maybe 3 years, just because it's great. Pull it out at corporates, everyone loves it. You know, it's a great way of introducing who I am, what I do. But it feels so lazy now because it's second nature to me. It doesn't feel, you know, and I think, oh God, I feel like an old fraud. I feel like old hat type thing.
Yes, I mean that constantly. That thing, I completely agree. I've got bits that I do. I go, oh, I'm doing that again. But why not? It's new. They've never heard it. It's new to them.
Yeah.
It works really well.
Yeah.
Morecambe and Wise did the same five minutes for 30 years before I got on telly, or 20 years, or whatever it was. You know, it's new. It's new to them. But I know at the same time that I completely see it from inside. You know, from the performer's point of view, it's like, oh God, is there going to be someone at the back of the room who's seen me do this 20 times? And you know.
Yeah, absolutely. You can just sing along.
yeah. Last thing that I wanted to ask about. Thank you. I've really enjoyed this.
Okay, good. Have I lived up to everybody else?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I may as well say this now, but I hope we've managed to cut the worst of it, but I have got the most rumbly tummy I've ever had. I was eating Shreddies as you came in, and I was like, oh, I better get these finished. So I can only apologise that with some really silent silences in this interview, which is always what we're after, some really good, I really feel like you went there, and I really appreciate it. And I'm only sorry that in the background, I hope none of you know anybody
I think
is going to hear a kind of
just being empathetic.
Yeah, maybe it was. I'm an empathetic guy. So it is, I think, for someone in your position, someone who has got big punchy skill, big punchy talent as a kind of a base, it would be easy for you to do those little get outs, you know, in a kind of interview thing. You just go, oh, you know, oh, I'm such a wanker, you know, and you go, actually, who are you really? And I think you've got into that quite honestly, and I appreciate that.
Okay.
The last thing I want to talk about is perhaps related to that. I am proud not to have known until an hour before you came over that you'd done Britain's Got Talent. I don't engage with that world at all. To me, it's like reviews. It's like a whole other thing.
Yeah.
So an hour and a half before you arrived this morning, I was like, oh, I just, what's that other, did someone say she'd been in blah, blah, blah. Oh, shit, you're on Britain's Got Talent. So I watched your audition.
Yeah.
And there seemed to me, from the small amount of digging that I did, not hardly digging, that there was an issue with your Britain's Got Talent experience. Can we talk about that?
Because yeah,
I would love to know what that feels like from the inside.
Yeah.
So tell us what happened.
I think I'd been scouted by them for about 4 years or something, and I'd always gone, no, I'm not doing that. I want to do it the old-fashioned way. I didn't really watch BGT very much, and I was very, very against doing it. I just didn't want to. And I think it drove me to do my first Edinburgh, because I thought, no, this isn't the way I want to, you know, want to do it the proper way. And then last year, they came to us again and just, you know, sat down and said, look, it will be really collaborative. It will be really a lovely experience. You'll have fun. We'll work with you if you get through. And I thought about it for a long time, and I discussed it with my manager and people like that. And it was all, you know, completely up to me. And in the end, I thought, why not? I'm going to do it. It will open me up to a whole new audience. Might sell more tickets for Edinburgh. There's no other platform like it to show what I do and come on what I do is kind of mainstream. And, you know, maybe it will be amazing and I'll go down really well and, you know, it will give me a massive, massive boost. It is the most nerve-wracking thing I have ever done. Just from sitting there, I think we were there from 12 hours, from 9 till 9. 9 o'clock in the evening is when I went on. And we were waiting in a holding room full of all these mad characters. I mean, it was like being in a weird sort of merry-go-round dream or something. It was so odd. I was sitting next to a bloke, a singing telegram dressed as Robin Hood, who offered me his card and said, would I like to be a Shirley Bassey singing telegram?
There's always that.
So there's that. And there were dog acts, real dog acts. And like, it was just weird. It was weird. And all day you're being interviewed and they're saying, so on a scale of 1 to 10, how nervous are you? Are you nervous? Can you just say that you're quite nervous? Okay, so you're nervous, are you? Or can you just sit there? We're just going to film you for a bit. Can you just look a bit nervous? And fuck me, it made me really nervous. So by the time I went on, and you're being filmed pacing up and down, you're being filmed, you know, constantly, and being, you're talking to other contestants, and the cameras are on you all day. And then you go on a coach to the London Palladium. I've never sung in front of that many people before, performed in front of that many people. And suddenly Anton Deck are there and they're like, okay, let's go. And they're not from Yorkshire. and you're like, what now? So I wasn't even ready. I mean, after all of that long time, you didn't know that. And then you walk out on stage and, you know, you walk out and David Walliams has his back to you, just talking to the audience. Simon's drinking his coffee. You know, Amanda's scratching her head and you just stand there and it's like going into the lion's den. It is really, really terrifying. And I did not think ever that I would be as nervous as that. I just didn't. And I was totally, like, I'm embarrassed by how nervous I was. And they asked me lots of questions, quite a long interview, which they cut down to their favourite moments. That's all I'll say about that. And then I performed, and then there was this enormous standing ovation from 2,000 people in the London Palladium, and I just nearly cried. It was so overwhelming and wonderful. And when I went off, I felt so low.
Because?
I thought I'd done a really crappy performance. I thought that, you know, the nerves had really got in the way and I thought I'd done a really crappy performance. But I also, I don't know, why did I feel so low? I felt really shit. I felt shocking for the next few days, actually. Maybe it was just really overwhelming. There's a tiny voice in my head that wants to say, oh, maybe I had sold out type thing. But I don't think it is that. I think it was just that massive whoosh of, I don't know, of adulation. And I was knackered and it was just the most intense experience. I felt very, very, very vulnerable.
Yeah. I mean, it is one of the... It's the deal with the devil doing a show like that, isn't
100%.
It? 100%. Because as a performer, as an experienced professional, we all know, and I would imagine that most people listening to this will be aware of the kind of the behind-the-scenes culture of Britain's Got Talent, whereby it seems like every couple of months, someone I know on Facebook who's a professional performer will go, bloody hell, I've just been asked to do Britain's Got Talent. And then there'll be this huge debate raging underneath it between professional performers under the post going, absolutely don't do that. Don't do that.
Yeah.
And then, you know, their family members and friends outside the industry going, oh, go on, could be a really great sort of thing, you know.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And it seems to me, well, I mean, I understand that this is the kind of the behind the scenes culture of it. is that pros are kind of courted and they say, oh, we'll put you straight in the semis and you can do this, that.
Didn't
you know
say
I mean?
That to me.
Fine, okay. Sure. But that is, I think, that, you know, people have... I've certainly got friends who've kind of taken a photo of the letter and put that on Facebook and said,
oh,
hey,
wow.
Look, they're offering me straight through to the semis.
Oh,
and they're
wow.
Going to... Yeah, absolutely.
Why didn't they do that for me?
Well, you know, I guess it is to do with... I don't know what it's to do with. It's to do with people's, either someone's standing in the industry, their level of experience, how maybe it's to do with the producers and how far they think you'll get, or whether they would rather you, whether it's about negotiating. Maybe if they say, come and do it, and you go, well, I'm not going to sit in a queue and audition. They go, ah, you don't have to do that. But maybe if you don't say that, then you sit in a queue and audition. Who knows? But I think that thing of it being a deal with the devil is like, for the first time, perhaps, in your performing life, you give up all creative control.
Yeah.
You give up editorial control. Yeah. I had a friend who did, he's a circus performer. He did Australia's Got Talent a few years ago, and he did fine. And then he dropped one of his props, and he's got a joke about he's juggling fire. He's got a joke about when he juggles fire and he drops something. And they cut the joke and cut to an audience booing a different act.
Yeah.
And edited that together so it looked like he'd had this terrible show. And it's just a lie, and, you know, that goes out to quadrillions of people.
Yeah.
And
I was very, very, very frightened about that.
Yeah. So, but that's the deal, isn't it? Because if you can put up with that, and if you can give up that control and they're nice to you and it works, and
you
have a good gig and they say the right thing, then maybe the result, you know, maybe the benefits could be enormous.
Mm.
Best case scenario, you win, it launches this whole other...
Yeah. I did, in my audition at the, like, the one that they showed, the first audition, I did Adele. And Simon said, that is the worst Adele impression I've ever heard. So I was really scared that, and then they cut that bit out, and they cut out lots and lots and lots of the act. And then for the semi-finals, from, like, February... until the day before I was supposed to go on, the act was changing every 2 seconds, changing. And I was going to do a bit of Jessie J doing Bang Bang. And then the Manchester bombings happened and...
Oh, yeah, of course.
I just thought
can't do it, yeah.
Can't do it. And they were going, no, it'll be fine. It'll be fine.
No, we, with no stake in your career whatsoever, think it'll be fine.
So I think there was the conversation if Twitter explodes about this, oh no, I shouldn't have said that, but you know, if Twitter goes mental,
yeah.
What will you defend Jess? No. You know, so then my act completely changed again. And they really wanted me to do Adele, and I was saying, no, but Simon didn't like it the first time, so I don't want to do it. And they were going, no, he won't remember. He doesn't remember what he had for lunch. You know, it's all fine, blah, blah, blah. And I did it. And, of course, Simon hated it and slated it on the live semi-finals, and I felt like a right prat. But I'm... I don't know. I still replay it in my head and wish that I'd done something else for the semi-finals, and wonder if I could have got through to the finals. I'm still replaying it all the time.
Isn't that infuriating that they treat you like shit, and then you're such a people pleaser, you're thinking, how could I have pleased them?
Yeah.
Isn't that awful?
Yeah, I guess so. But individually, they were lovely. What I didn't take into account, and I should have, it was naive of me, but it's about their TV show. It's not about your act or making you look good or, you know, helping you or giving you a leg up. It's not about any of that. It's about making a brilliant, entertaining TV show for the people that watch BGT. So you're just a pawn, and it's how you use that afterwards. And luckily and brilliantly, I've got a lovely, lovely manager who's like a big sister to me, and she had lovely meetings set up and things like that. And it's opened doors for me with, you know, just meeting producers and directors that I wouldn't have got this time last year.
Good.
Just wouldn't have. Because it's raised my profile. But it was terrifying. And I came home from the semi-finals And I just sobbed and sobbed and sobbed. I felt humiliated and I felt ashamed and I felt dirty. I felt awful. I was just horrible. And, you know, for the next few days, I was just like a bit of a zombie.
Yeah.
It was really just emotionally exhausting and upsetting and depressing and gross. And I felt like through all of that, I should have just been my... I didn't come across the way I wanted to come across. I didn't, yeah. You know, I... That...
Can anyone come across the way they want to come across?
I don't know. Probably not, because you're not in control of it, are you?
But it is peculiar. It's very weird to me seeing in the last few years. I feel like 5 years ago, if you were a person on the comedy circuit and you went on Britain's Got Talent... You were a bit of an outcast.
Well, that's how I feel. Like, I'm worried about that, people will think.
But I think it has changed within the last 5 years, whereby people regard it as a thing you can do now. If you look at Joel Dommett doing I'm a Celebrity, when he went in, everyone went, oh, Christ, Dommett's fucked himself. What's he going to do? And then he came out and he came second or something.
Yeah, he did
now
really well.
Now he's got half a million Instagram followers, whatever. And
DeLiso
suddenly he
did brilliantly on it.
Absolutely.
Oh, my God.
So DeLiso did great.
He was so chilled.
Yes, yeah.
Backstage, he was just chilled. I was worrying about what shoes they were going to put me in and all of that. He was chilled. I said, are you all right? Are they changing your act as well? And he was like, yeah, they're changing it. It's fine. And he just went out and smashed it. I was in awe of him.
Some people are kind of... Everyone responds to pressure differently. I've had DeLiso on the show, but a couple of years ago, before he sort of got into it, I'd be interested to talk to him about it now because it's such a risk.
Yeah.
And then the other thing that I think happened was there were I don't know how much of a real thing it was. You know when awful online newspapers take three tweets and go, "There's an outcry," and you go, "Is there an outcry, or have you just created an outcry?"
Yes.
You know, and I think people. I think when pros go on Britain's Got Talent or equivalent shows, there is a sort of a tightrope that one has to walk whereby everyone knows you're a professional, but they've invited you on the show, so you're allowed to be there. And then the audience kind of go, hey, what's
Hang
this?
On
She's
a minute.
Professional.
I'm calling her out. I saw her Edinburgh show 2 years ago.
Yeah.
Or... Hang on a minute.
Like she's a ringer. Do you know what I mean? Like she's like, they think, you know, wait a minute, she's a fake. She's a phony because actually she's already a professional performer.
Yeah.
You go, all of these people aren't they? Unless they're, you know, crazy chicken
Absolutely.
Guy or you know.
Yeah.
So how did that feel?
That was horrible.
I mean, was it
I was worried that would happen, but I just thought, you know, it'll be okay if they've invited me to go
it's
and audition.
It's not like you lied to the producers.
No. And I said on stage as well, I'm a performer. I don't know whether they cut that bit out. I don't know. You know, they make their TV show and they edit it in their way. But I've been plugging away for years. I've been, you know, I've taken my show to Edinburgh.
You can
I've
see
lost
how
some
they
money.
Wouldn't,
I've...
They wouldn't want to include you saying I've been plugging away for years because that doesn't fit their narrative of having discovered you.
No. Yeah. Yeah, see, yeah. So when that happens, if they discovered you and then it turns out you're a phony, it's not them that get attacked for it, it's you.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was a bit shit. It wasn't nice. And then I had to go and do interviews and videos saying I've been plugging away for years and, you know, I've lost money in Edinburgh and things like that. And that suddenly becomes a big story. But everybody's lost money in Edinburgh.
Yeah,
that's
right.
What you do.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's like a story. I've lost £4,000 or something. I think people have lost more than that. I think probably had a lucky escape.
Yeah.
But backlash. BGT backlash. And then there was stuff that came out about
there's
them.
A good name for an Edinburgh show.
Jesus Christ.
Sales
yeah.
tickets.
Yeah.
And then what? Sorry, there's some stuff that came out about.
Oh, about I think the photographer for our wedding sold some pictures to the Sun. I was like, oh, you douchebag!
Oh, mate. But that's all part of the deal, isn't it?
Yeah.
And I think this if something can be useful, like obviously this has been useful to you in some ways. You can get you maybe got access to meetings you wouldn't have had before.
Yeah.
And you're in the position whereby you're not some you know, barking mad person off the street.
Yeah.
You've got, like Joel was in that position of going, oh, now I can, I'm already on tour, now I can just quadruple, yeah. you know, times by 10.
I don't think I disgraced myself.
Absolutely
but I don't,
not.
I have really, really mixed feelings about it. I think if I hadn't done it, I would have wondered always what would have happened if I had.
Okay.
And I thought maybe I can be different and maybe I can get through to the finals and people can just see me and sure. love me and it would be wonderful. And also, I just think, oh, I wish I hadn't done that act. I wish I'd done a different one. Or,
sure,
you know,
sure.
I'm still beating myself up about that. And it was in June.
I hope that people listen to this or link to it when that conversation goes on Facebook between, you know, this is the, you know, like to hear an inside perspective of how much control you surrender and how much, yes, suddenly that might be part of it. Your wedding photographer might sell your photos.
Yeah.
If you walk through door A.
Yeah.
That could happen.
That's right. It's horrible. My ex-mother-in-law was doorstepped by some photographers, God knows, and journalists, God knows how they found out where she lived or anything. But they did that before my first audition aired. And that's how she and my ex found out that I was going on Britain's Got Talent. And I think my ex was probably shitting himself because he was worried about other things coming out, which they didn't. It wasn't just my life that it affected. It was everything, everyone, my poor dad. Just, you know, just going down to the village shop and there was, clickbait. Clickbait's good, isn't it? Jess Robinson in raunchy ... circus act.
Yeah.
And it was just got me wearing a red dress. That was fine. But, nothing raunchy about any of it. But I think my dad found it quite alarming to have his daughter in the papers just anywhere. I think he found it quite weird and sick and not nice and it was quite, you know, it was probably more stressful and more upsetting than the breakup in some ways, that whole experience.
God.
It's not for the faint-hearted. And I still don't, I think I'm glad that I did it. I think I am because it's paying off career-wise, and hopefully I'll sell some tickets for my tour, and hopefully, you know, it will help me have a leg up. I don't know. I feel funny about it still.
So to wrap up then, your tour.
Yes.
What can we expect from your tour? When are you touring now? Are you touring early next year?
Spring.
Start?
Yeah. Spring. Start in the spring. It's just me with some incredible tracks made by the wonderful Lawrence Owen, who you should have on this show, musical comedian. It's called Here Come the Girls, and it's
a great title.
Thank you.
That's a great title for a one-woman show.
Yeah. I've got 4 years worth of material from all my Edinburgh shows and all of that I can choose the best of and just go out there and entertain people. And it'll be a bit scary to just be on my Todd, actually. It'll be a learning curve for me. But I'm really, really looking forward to it. It's just going to be good and, you know, fun times, celebratory, stupid, and a warm night that it's safe to bring your parents to. I won't say fuck or bugger. It's for everyone, really. Yeah, and a bit about sort of what makes my mind work, and probably not quite as in-depth as this, but yeah.
So what do you want?
I want to be a contestant on Strictly Come Dancing one day. She says after talking about the horrors of BGT. No, what do I want? I'd love to have my own show one day on TV where I can be a bit of a Bruce Forsyth, a bit of a Cilla Black, a bit of a all-round entertainer, have celebrities on and interview them and do a little bit of a double act with them and do some songs and some entertaining, maybe some pranks, things like that. I'd love that.
That's a pretty specific goal. That's great.
Is it?
Yeah.
Well, we'll see if it happens. It won't. Get out and drink now.
Thank you for spotting.
Now. I want a dog that can come on tour with me and maybe sit under the piano.
That's an achievable dream.
But I think it will steal the limelight. What I really, 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 really want, I guess, is to feel like I've done it right and I've been a good girl. I really want to just feel content with myself and like, I don't know, one day that would be nice, that I can just sit back and enjoy the ride rather than keep fighting.
That's great to hear. And I have a similar desire for my own career, for my own practice. But I practice. That may be the most pretentious thing I've ever said.
Yeah, like yoga.
Yeah.
Don't compare your practice to anyone else's. It's your practice.
Is that right? Is that right? Oh, yeah. That's a yoga thing.
Actually,
okay.
I do like yoga. That's been happening quite a lot recently. That helps.
Okay. I find myself also, I also find myself thinking, oh, it'll be good when this is all done. And I can look back on it.
Yeah.
Is that healthy?
No, because it's not. Because we're missing it all now, aren't we?
Well, we're not missing it. We're participating it. But I think...
But oh, my God. Participating, majating.
A lot... What does that even mean?
It means, like, participating to such a degree that you're almost missing it. That you can't appreciate it while it's all happening. I should be just being really pleased with myself right now. And just, you know, patting myself on the back and going to have a hot chocolate.
Because otherwise, when does that moment happen?
I don't know.
I'd see myself in a small retirement place, aged 80 and famous and with the life of Barry Cryer.
Yeah,
lovely Barry.
Lovely Barry.
Then you could go, right, Barry is sort of in his house with his wife and they've got all their, you know, he's got all his accolades, all his lovely photos and things on the wall of all these people he's worked with and stuff. And he can finally sit and ruminate.
I bet he's not feeling like that yet, is he?
I don't know. I don't think I asked that. It would have seemed impertinent, dear Baz. But I wonder if that's a real thing. Or is it just a fleeting thing that every so often you're in Cheveley services and you just have a moment of thinking, oh, this is going all right. Is that all we recorded?
Please not in a service station. I don't know. I feel like I'm still at the beginning. I feel like there's still so much to do and achieve. Yeah. But I don't know when will I know? When will you know? That's what my therapist, what do you want? How will you get it? When will you know when you have it?
That's what I do.
Do you?
That's what I ask people. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Only I haven't done any training.
Wow, do it. I should, probably don't need to.
When will you know? Yeah, that's
how. That's how will you know when you have it? I don't.
How will you know when you have it?
I'll be in a lovely house with my dog. I don't know.
Will all the people be pleased enough one day?
Yeah. No, there are always going to be people that won't like me. There are always going to be people I can't please and I can't make like me.
Yeah, and you have to be okay with that.
Yeah, that's the next bit. That's the next stew wisdom that I need to carry with me for the next 4 years. I'll come back and tell you how I've done.
This has become far too much about me.
Yeah.
Come back and tell me how you've done. All right. Thanks a lot, Jess.
Thank you.
Thank you, Jess. I really appreciate your honesty. I really enjoyed that conversation. And if you would like to see the brilliant Jess Robinson on tour or anywhere else, you can get in touch with her at Jessie Robinson on Twitter. That's J-E-S-S-I-E. Jessie Robinson on Twitter. And Jess's website, jessrobinson.co.uk, is linked in the show notes to this episode. You can find out more about her and her tour. Do yourself a favour and go along and see her. She's very good, with very good recorded stuff online. Go and see her live. You will weep with joy and hilarity, and it just
wild appreciation of her really amazing talent. So thanks to Jess for coming along. Thank you to Nathan Wood for your editing skills. Thanks to Matt Hoss for some terrific logging for this episode. And I think that's all the thank yous officially. I'm going to leave it there for now. I will be back. I'll do a little post-amble in a minute, but let's conclude the podcast with this. We will be back with James Acaster in the middle of January. I'm going on honeymoon, so we're going to skip a few episodes over January, but there will be a galumphing great James Acaster episode. I think we've got time and plenty to talk about, so it might even be a double. We'll have to see. That is coming up. So look out for that. If you would like to stick around for a little Christmas message from me and the Boutros, you can hear that in the post-amble in just a moment. But for now, happy Christmas to you, and that concludes the podcast. Donate at comedianscomedian.com/donate, and find out about the tour at comedianscomedian.com/tour. Speak to you soon. So here we go. I just wanted to quickly read this because, I'm just going to quickly read this and you'll see why. So this is an email I got from someone called Alexander, who I mentioned in the last episode. I thanked a few people for donating to the show, and this is an abridged version of his email. He writes, "I heard my name mentioned in your latest episode where you thanked people, and this is going to sound corny, but I welled up with tears and had to pause the podcast. It was a reference to," he goes on to talk about the Sarah Kendall interview. He says, "That, I'm talking about that stuff. I'm talking about that odd mix of laughing and crying at the same time, about mental pain, about values in life, the frustration of living in this world, the oddness we feel as humans, and how, very often, the funny tips the balance and you can keep going because you think keep going is a better option all of a sudden. I won't trouble you with the details, but you made a lot of wonderful difference to me and my closest just by doing what you do, and I appreciate it so much. When you mentioned my name, it felt like a callback to all of that, like an exchange of gratitude and appreciation between two best friends. No, I know the reality of it," he says. "No need to look out between curtains for creepy stalkers, thank you. I'm just talking about an odd psychological sphere of connection that was wonderful and almost a bit reassuring, calming, milestone-y, not sure. I felt connected to a virtual friend I knew had a manifestation on the other side of the planet, far, far away. And isn't technology wonderful? And isn't this modern age of talking about emotions awesome? And besides all the shit that's happening in the world and all the revelations of just how shitty we humans can be to each other and the selfish nature we very often wrap ourselves in, isn't this just a 2-second digital flare of hope and kindness, a glimmer of goodness? I'm one of many who probably keep thinking they should donate as soon as I get a spare moment. I simply got a spare moment. So thank you, Stu. I love what you do, love the show, good luck with your upcoming stuff, and keep asking if they're happy, as long as you don't ask me." Now, thank you. I was reading that. You know, you're always sort of wandering around the house looking at your phone idly, behind your child's back, trying not to let him know how much you're looking at your phone. I just got out of the shower and was walking along wearing my towel in my bedroom with my phone in one hand, like I was playing music while I was in the shower, and I got out of the shower, and I read that in my on my phone, and because I just got a little notification, and I punched the air and my towel fell off. I'm not asking you to visualize that. I'm just saying it was a special moment. And this is to everyone now. I've had such a good year. I've had such an incredible year. I got married. I had the best Edinburgh I've had in 24 years. The tour was great. I played Wembley Arena. The Boutros started talking. In a few weeks from now, we're all going on honeymoon together. The boy's coming with us as well in New Zealand, which is going to culminate in a run at the World Buskers Festival in Christchurch. Hashtag always working. And it's been such an incredible year. And I just want to say, I was very moved by that email. I love the idea of a 2-second digital flare of hope. That's beautifully put. And so it inspired me, given that this is the last one this year, and there'll be some great big James Acaster banging great episodes coming your way soon, but there'll be a couple of weeks off. I just wanted to take this opportunity to say thank you to you, to all of you, not just to my wife and child and all of my colleagues and friends and everyone in comedy and my management who've looked after me so well this year, but to you. This podcast has... I'm sort of slightly doing it. I've written down loosely what I want to say and I started reading it out there. I'm going to not read it out. What I'm trying to say is, doing this show has changed my life. And it feels like every day something brilliant happens. I get an email or a Facebook message or a tweet, or someone gets in touch or stops me in the street and says hello, or someone somehow tells me that this thing is making a difference to their life, or it just in some way they just... you just sort of go, nice one, Stu, keep going. And and I punch the air and my towel falls off. So, thank you. Thank you. Have a very happy Christmas, everybody. Have a brilliant new year. I'll be back in mid-January with an episode with Mr. James Acaster. And there's plenty more in the can. We've got a brilliant one with Colin Holt coming up. I've still got K. Trevor Wilson from Montreal, which is lovely. And Julio Torres from, well, he's LA, but I did him in Edinburgh. And Anne Edmonds from Melbourne earlier this year. There's loads of stuff to come. Plenty more in the diary. So finally, I will leave you with this Christmas message from me and the Boutros.
Happy Christmas.
That's right.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.